Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the Metaphysical Hour. And today is November the 13th, 2015. I had to think about it because I am finally back. This actually is a live show. I'm finally back from, I think it's been, was it 7 weeks?
Oh my God,
8
yeah.
weeks? This is Julia Cannon, and I am joined by Shonda Garrison. Yeah, whoop whoop. But yeah, finally back. Yay. So thank you for being patient with us. I was on that round the world trip doing the classes, and so we've got that done. Yay. And that was wonderful, wonderful experiences. And we were so looking forward to it. And now those are done. And now we're planning next year. So we just don't rest.
No, we don't.
We never do. Never do. And we are planning some really exciting things. We have many events and classes and all kinds of things coming up next year. And we're posting them. Your fingers. I don't think they're.
Yeah, my little fingers haven't rested in days.
Going crazy. But they're all getting posted on there. We're ahead. We're doing so good.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, you're pretty much getting everything posted for next year, aren't you?
Yes.
Yeah, so they can go ahead and start looking on the websites on OzarkMT.com and DoloresCannon.com and QHHTOfficial.com. That's a new website for everybody.
Yes.
that got launched while I was on this trip.
Yes.
So those of you that, you know, weren't aware of it, that's something new that happened. See? Don't rest on your laurels. We don't. So don't you. So anyway, a new website that happened while we were gone. So anyway, that's new things happening. What's coming up immediately, well, not immediately, but immediately to us is the next class, and that will be in
Burbank, California.
Oh, I guess that is the next one, isn't it?
Yeah, that one is the next one.
I was going for the one right after that one.
Lima, Peru?
Yeah, the Peru, yes. So, yeah, so we have California and then Peru.
Yes.
Yeah, so those two are coming right up. So, very cool.
Yes, that's exciting.
Yeah, and then we have another cool thing that we're working on and will be announced very soon. So that's a new little program that we're starting that will probably come out. We'll probably be ready to announce it next week, I bet.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So. I mean, that's us always evolving. And then we have the conferences.
In April.
April, the UFO and the Transformation Conferences. We've actually moved them together. They're together in April. And so you'll see more information on those at the OzarkMT.com. You'll get the links to those sites from there and get all that information. So that's very exciting. And actually, our speaker tonight happens to be, I mean, our guest tonight, can I still claim having no brain?
No.
No?
You've been back long enough. No, you can't do that.
I don't know. I've been still doing some pretty lame brain things.
Well, I'll give you another week. How about that?
That'd be wonderful. That would really be wonderful. I mean, because it was all the way around the world, and I did it backwards.
Okay, I'll give you another week.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And there was a time change, and there was, what else
came in? Time change, a lot of no rest with launching that website.
Yeah.
Didn't you lose a whole day whenever you went from Australia to Hawaii, or gained a whole day? I don't know.
I lost a day, then I gained a day, and then I gained a day, then I lost a day, and then the time changed.
That's enough time travel. Yeah, I'll give you another week.
Yeah, I'm lost in some time portal, and then but there is no time, and so as Lee's going to explain, so you know. So anyway, anyway, it doesn't mean whatever. So our guest tonight is a speaker at the Transformation Conference, which will be in April.
Yes.
And he's probably going, what am I even involved with now? So I'm wondering. So, anyway, I want to welcome you aboard, and we're so honored to have you with us tonight, Lee. Lee Sumter, everybody. Welcome.
Well, actually, I feel like the honor is mine. I feel very, very honored that things have rolled around to the point where I am participating with the efforts of Ozark Mountain Publishing to actually, I feel like it's a promulgation, you know. And as a matter of fact, you know, I admire your traveling. And I think it's just, to me, when I first heard of the work that your mother did, I heard her speak at a conference in Johnson City 3, 4, or 5 years ago. And she arrived in Johnson City from Moscow that day and was brought in from the airport and put in a chair on the, well, she got herself into the chair on the stage. And proceeded to give a just brilliant, talk for an hour or so. Excuse me. But she had been in Moscow demonstrating the hypnosis and speaking, and then that's what you have picked that up, and you're continuing to do it. And I think that it's such a big thing that this teaching is being done all around the world. Actually, there was a lady that was publishing about the same time I was. I think I have her, yeah, the Dawn book, Annie Stillwater Gray.
Yeah.
And one of her main things was that information is coming to a lot of different people around the world. And, of course, you're helping to let that in, and you're stimulating that, and you're opening up people's minds. And one of my big interests here is receptivity. When I started writing this book, We Are the Creators, and I want to pick it up and hold it in front of the camera, you know, but you've said, no, this is just audio.
Well, you can do that. Nobody will see it, but you can do it.
I know. Well, I just, there's certain things that I'm doing here that are a practice. One of the things I will say is that I've often thought, okay, now when I get in one of these forums where I need to discuss things, I humbly say, well, I just don't think I know very much, and I've been informed that I will turn out to know more than I thought I did. That I'm very interested in the advancing openness towards spiritual, metaphysical type things. And when I first started this book, I have a good friend who is an Akashic reader. She's become a very good friend, and she's coached me through this and gotten into all kinds of esoteric explanations of microbiology and physics, and it's been pretty amazing. And then she'd say, "Well, I really don't know anything about any of this. I just, I just cope with the grocery store." But yet she was explaining things that were very deep phenomenology. Nevertheless, we're after a greater receptivity. And she said that this book would be about choices. First of all, she told me I was not writing a series of essays, but I was writing a book. And on a whim, I just decided to get a reading. And that's why she said I was writing the book. Now, this is all in the introduction. And she said the book was about choices. Like many other things that I was told, that I was informed of when I was putting this together, it took me over a year to understand what she meant by that. And I slowly have come to understand that as people are having trouble hanging with, let me call, orthodox religious teaching, they're having trouble trying to find alternatives to these things, then the kinds of work that you do and the kinds of things that I've been called upon to write, and I'm writing constantly, are offering choices. And people now, the message here, the message in this book, one of the things that this book is about is that it's actually one of the big teachings of Jesus of Nazareth is search inside. The truth is inside of you. But you have to believe that, and you have to accept that you have the ability to receive this truth. I was thinking about today, one of the issues that I came upon when it came to, how should I say, being a channel, channeling information, was worthiness. People have some problem with, oh, well, I'm not worthy of getting a message from some higher spiritual entity or an angel or something from heaven. But in fact, you are getting these messages all the time, but you just to block them out.
Absolutely.
I'm sorry.
I said absolutely. That's, yes. You know, because we were told we can't do that.
It's yes.
Not allowed, you know, or things like that. Before you get too much further, Lee, I want to give out the toll-free number where people can call in if they want to.
Absolutely.
And also, I would like to... And then I want to do something else here for a minute, okay? So let me do that real quick because I forgot to do that on the front end. So if anybody does want to call in and ask any questions of Lee during the show, the toll-free number is 1-888-627-6008. 1-888-627-6008. Now, something I like to do, Lee, before we get going too much further into this, because I know this is fascinating as you keep going here, but I'd like to give a little bit of background first before you go into your story.
Of course.
Where did you start? You know, like a little bit of your background and everything. I saw in your bio and everything, you were a teacher first, but did and engineering even and stuff. You have your background.
Yes.
Like, I loved for people to see that you maybe didn't necessarily. You weren't always into this, maybe, because
no,
people
yes
come
and no.
from all sorts of backgrounds, you know.
Yes. Well, this is another thing, is that everybody has these experiences, and because of conditioning of every kinds, you may have a family culture, you may have a neighborhood or community culture where these things are taboo or forbidden, or you're just they just don't exist, and this sort of thing. And you have to start opening yourself up. And actually, this is where a crisis serves. Many times we become, you know, if we get into a crisis of some kind, we feel like it's out of our control. We call upon higher powers, you know, and we're receptive at that point. And, you know, everybody's had these experiences, and it helps to remember what you did then, how receptive you were, and how it helped. And this is something that is available all the time, every day. I was talking to Shonda earlier, and I said, I've got this thing about aggressive engagement. I'm making this up as I go along, just like I do everything.
Go for it. Mm-hmm.
But you, it's necessary to ask questions of the universe. You can ask questions. If you have mysteries in your life, then you can ask. And the asking itself is an intent. And intent creates reality. And, you know, it has all of the energy. Just asking brings out the energy. It's hard to explain the power of the question. They want all of the people that have been assigned to you to help you through your life, which are numerous. And it's not always the same people all the way through your life. They ask for more chances to help. And they just say, just if you would just call upon us and if you would just ask. And people don't really know to do this. Okay, now, you know, I studied up on the metaphysical hour by listening to a couple of other hours. And one of them, you had this Maria Eugenia, and you asked her, you know, had she always been metaphysical or spiritual or whatever? Mm-hmm. And I anticipated your question. And really, when I started writing seriously in this area. I started, everybody, that's what everybody who gets involved in this does. They start doing this backtracking. Well, when did I first become aware? Yeah, well, I have to say it's kind of from the age of consciousness, you know, when I was in my early teens. I have, I'm a person, as I explain in the book, who has always been beset by deja vu experiences. Deja vu is just, I've lived with it. And it terrified me. Well, you know, if you're a small child and you have this shock of recognition that you've seen something before, and you not only do you know you've seen it before, but you recognize distinct details. And, you know, in my experience, many times I could remember when I had had the vision or the dream or whatever it was that I was now seeing. And that so it was just all tied down. It was very hard to deny, you know. I didn't go to anybody and talk to anybody about it. I didn't know to do that. I assumed that everybody had deja vu experiences, which actually is partly true. To a large extent, it's true. But anyway, I had these from the very beginning. I also, as I said in my bio, I was studying philosophy. I was reading books about flying saucers. Any kind of thing that was, I call it maverick science. I do maverick science, geology, history, all that sort of thing. And of course, you published the books of a grandson of a maverick anthropologist and historian who has made very important contributions to the whole picture, very, very important. And he's on the outside of the, you know, the formal historical environment, you know, the university environment. But so be it. So much the better, I think.
Absolutely.
But anyway, so I always was reading these things and I was always pondering, but I would have the deja vu. And then finally the deja vu evolved to where I was actually able to see things. And I was in a crisis situation. I was looking for answers. I was looking for what was going to happen. Where was I going to be? And I found that I could see, I could have visions. And I actually I found a job in New England because I kept having visions of stone walls and broad valleys in color, bright, bright color. And I have traveled a lot. I've traveled all the United States, and I knew that was New England. Mm-hmm. There was just nothing else that's like that, you know. And sure enough, I started making calls to school districts in New England, and I had interviews within half an hour where I had gotten nowhere before that. So actually, I have used the visions to guide me in lots and lots of ways. They serve as confirmation, and then they serve as a guidance of, you know, what direction I should take. So actually, I think I was put on this earth to do this. I mean, it's gotten down to that. All of us really have in one way or another. But now for me personally, it's become a mission, and I take it very seriously, and I constantly study. Constantly taking notes and learning. I'm constantly learning, and it's really great. Now, sometimes the learning experiences are shocking. For instance, I have a guide that I'm privileged to have work with me, and this guide comes from what was a continent in the Pacific. You know, it's called Lemuria. And this guy was giving me a tour of a part of Lemuria, a village, while I was driving down the interstate.
Oh, cool.
And yes, this is very distracting, but I was fine. I mean, something was getting me down the interstate, and there wasn't a lot of traffic. But inside my head was a movie going on where I was being shown. And I didn't understand what I was being shown for some time, because it was just simply outside of my what we know because of our life. Okay. And one of the big things about this is the capability of the people, the legends of the people of Lemuria and of Atlantis, their spiritual powers, these are returning. There's a great awakening that's going on. And see, you're helping. You're one of the great awakeners. You know, maybe, yes, I think you do see yourself that way, but that's exactly what you are. I have no doubt that people who have had the experience of the hypnotic regression find that they then maybe can see auras where previously they couldn't as well. Maybe they find that they suddenly have intuitions about people that are close to them, or maybe even people who just come up to them. They find probably that they are finishing sentences that people are saying. They probably find that they know things that they didn't know that they knew. you know, lots of. I'm sure that their whole spiritual experience is considerably enhanced.
Absolutely.
And I expect that's an ongoing process. So I would say that this is something that has developed in me and has become more and more intense. I've had to have a re-education. I really have. I have very extensive classical education, you know, in primarily Western culture. I mean, I speak four languages. And there's a certain mindset that goes with all this. And, you know, when I started learning from the spiritual side, that was a different orientation and a different, a whole different outlook. And I had big arguments. And as I explained in the book, at times I would literally stomp out of the room. I'm not writing that. I'm not going to say that. That's too crazy. Everybody, you know, they'll run me out of the neighborhood and on and on and on. But then would begin a series of demonstrations and explanations. So once again, I could be driving down the road and then something would be pointed out to me on the side of the road and a big discussion would go on. And whatever's being pointed out would be evidence and proof of, you know, the alternative universe. Yeah, you're nodding your head like, yes, you're very familiar with this
experience. They've done that to me, yes.
Well, little by little, after sometimes several weeks, I say, okay. And then I sit down in front of the keyboard and I type out those sentences. And they weren't quite so shocking after I had all this explanation. And little by little, this built up till it became a whole world view. And then I had read several years ago, I'd read as much as I could of the Seth books. And, of course, that's a whole phenomenological reorientation. Mm-hmm. And you just, you know, you're reading these things and you're going, what? And interestingly, then now that's been thoroughly filled in and supported by what I've learned. And then I've learned still more. It's amazing how much you can know, if not from books, you know.
Yeah, do you find now, like I could only read them so far back in when I was reading the Seth books. It's interesting how we all have similar journeys, but the Seth books, I could only read them so far. I could only digest so much back then. And it was like my brain couldn't do anymore.
Yes.
And now I find that where it stopped back then, now it's like I'm getting information now that's filling in all the gaps.
Yes.
That I couldn't understand then. It's like now it's picking up where I left off, and now it's filling it in, and it's like it's okay now. If I picked up a Seth book about 10 years ago, and I remember I was like, oh yeah, but those are really hard for me to understand, and I picked it up, and it was like, this isn't hard to understand.
There you go, right? And you will find before long that you go beyond that.
Right.
For instance, Seth described how we actually, create our bubble of reality by projecting the brain. He said, he used the word chemicals. Seth spoke in the language that was fashionable at that time, in the 70s and 80s.
Right.
He used some psychological terms and some academic terms, and you use chemicals. Now, my teaching has been that we use proto-matter. We use a energy on the way to becoming matter. You know, there's been a lot of discussion recently of the God particle. There's this, I spent all these millions of dollars in Europe to build a magnetic system for trying to find this God particle, you know. Mm-hmm. And it amused me immensely because I was sitting there in my study writing about this. With this guidance, all the time that was going on. And for me, it was just part of the whole discussion. Whether you use the term chemical, obviously to describe these things the common language doesn't work very well. And I wanted to tell you, Julia, you know, there is a program, there are layers and layers of guidance in the spiritual world. And we are really all part of that. And we are in communication with all of that all the time. Mm-hmm. But when I read your mother's book, Five Lives, which was the first book she did. And she was describing, as you know, that she and your father's efforts to simply help someone with, I think, was it a drinking habit?
No, it was, she had, no, it was an overeating.
Overeating, that's right, a weight habit. And so they just, you know, resorted to hypnosis. But I had the strongest feeling, they didn't know what questions to ask. They didn't know what kind of answers they were supposed to. When they get answers, they didn't know what to do with them, you know. She goes down the list on some page or other of all of the things that we take for granted now that were unknown then, just totally unknown. And this was in the 50s, I think.
Was it
68? 68, see, it's not been that long, but things there's been a tremendous amount of progress. So anyway, I had the distinct, strongest feeling that even in that time, your mother and father were being guided in their questions.
Yes.
Questions were suggested to them so that they would get certain answers. And these answers would be appropriate for the reading audience at the time so that, you know, it would be the beginning. It was little baby steps, you know. Right. And I feel I've listened to some recordings of some other hypnotic sessions that your mother did. And I felt that continued, that we're being, you who practice this hypnotic regression, of course, you know, there are several of you. And I've talked about you in my articles, my various articles. I cite along with.
Well, thank you.
Bernard Wiss and this guy, Dr. Wright, and I don't know, there's several, you know, different things. Each of you finds different things. Mm-hmm. But I feel like that it's all a big program, and you're part of it. You know, you have been willing, and you're part of it, and you are guided. And the answers that come back are the kind of information that are that can have the most impact at the moment. And I asked, I should mention, this needs to be brought out here, that before I started, I asked the universe to see to it that the right people were listening to us tonight. You know, that's important. Absolutely. And or that eventually they will listen, you know, from the archives, etc.
Well, and that's a good point that you make, and that's something that we teach to do before a session. Practitioner will center themselves and ask for guidance to ask the very best questions to get the information that the client needs to help themselves. So see, that confirms what you're asking, what you're saying there, that yes, they are guided.
But those of us that are onlookers, see,
yes,
we have our own messages that come out of this. It's, you know, we couldn't do this if we tried to set it up. It's much too complicated. But I think that the message that there are layers and layers, if you really, there are hierarchies of spiritual souls that are in fact supervising. Now, this is a whole big discussion that off you go, you know, that are supervising what goes on here in the in our earthly existence that we are trying to create and are guiding us along. And then someone's going to jump up and say, well, how do they allow such horrible things to happen? Oh. but in fact, they do. And of course, a lot of it has to do with beliefs. And that's what we were saying earlier. I wanted to get to that. We are what we believe. Our beliefs are us. And to begin to sort through these beliefs and fix them up and throw out what doesn't work and take on new ones is very difficult. Even while you're examining your beliefs, you're using beliefs. You know, back in the days of transactional therapy, they used to say, you know, that the very tools you try to use to heal yourself are broken, you know. But anyway, our beliefs, but you can begin to do this. And you really, when you do, you find your heart and your mind are just opened up. And you'll find out that you're running around with all kinds of ideas that are against each other, working against each other, and they're keeping you from doing what you want to do. You'll stand there and say, I want to do this and that, and then you'll carry a couple of beliefs around that keep you from taking the first step, you know. So we need to have, we need to begin examining our beliefs so we can open our hearts to the help that comes. And of course, you know, again, if you just say, I want to be more receptive. I want to know. I want to be opened up to this. And, you know, I mean, people pray all the time. And this is a way of praying. And this can go on all the time. It's not something where you have to sit down in a corner necessarily. It helps to be quiet. And it helps to turn off the media. You know, I used to yell at my students all the time, turn all that stuff off and listen to yourself. And that's what you need to do. And actually now the book has a couple of addenda, which you encouraged. And one of them is a meditation that allows people. Now, this is not from me. This just came to me. And I've developed it with a workshop with more help. And this is a way for people to actually have the experience of being in heaven. And it actually works. I have tried it out, and it does work. And it's something so that a person can do this anytime they want, anywhere, as long as they can get focused. And this is, you know, this opens up, this experience opens up tremendous spiritual power. Tremendous. It's hard to imagine. I mean, I'm feeling the power now just talking about it. And opens all kinds of doors for people. Okay, now, the next thing I would ask is, what do you want me to do? I have an outline here. You know, people ask me, they'll come up and say, well, what's your book about? I wrote this book, you know, but I freeze. I just freeze. And I just do. Well,
it's about creating, obviously.
Yes.
Right. And it's how we create. I mean, because you go into in the middle of it here, there's a lot of detail in about how creation happens, how we create.
Well, really? Now, that was part of the fight that went on when this book got written. And the book is written in a very dense style. It is not so easy to read. And it's not a book where you can sit down and just read the words and you say, okay, I read the book. You have to go back. And people who have, particularly younger people, who have read it have said that to me. They said, oh, I loved your book, but I've had to go back and read different parts over and over. But my guides insisted that I was to lay out the arguments that the places where I wanted to elaborate had already been elaborated in, like, the Seth books, you know, and in, say, your mother's work, and this Dr. Wright, who, for instance, or Ruth Montgomery's books, or Sylvia Brown's books. People could go find multiple volumes that develop the details. I was to lay out the arguments, and I was instructed, and the arguments come out in as every with everyday details. The proofs for the arguments are what people have at their fingertips, what they see in their life every day. So it wasn't anything too exotic. Well, that's a pretty wild, crazy combination of things, you know, really. But yet they insisted that I go into that kind of detail. I'm not really responsible for what's there and how it came out. I did try to make it come out some other way, and I failed. So
yeah, and then they go, nope.
Yes, yes, it was, you know, and eventually, as you give in to this, then you get to more, you learn more, and you get to be able to do more and explain more. I mean, you know, it's a thing where you say, well, I didn't know I knew that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Now, yes, the first part of the book, besides being, you know, this all this physics, though, is history. And it's only the history of the last couple hundred years in the West. And one example I like to give, now, I live near Cumberland Gap in Kentucky, which is the gap between Virginia and Kentucky. People were walking from the coast in Virginia all through what's called the Valley of Virginia, which is the between the Alleghenies and Blue Ridge, just a bunch of geography. And they walked to this gap in the Cumberland Mountains, without which it was impossible to cross, really. And they walked. They did ride wagons finally to a city called, which is now called Bristol, Virginia. Previously, it was called Wolf Hollow or something like that. Mm-hmm. Anyway, when they got to the gap, when they tried to get past where Bristol, Virginia, there were still a couple hundred miles, and they had to get on horses and walk because it was cane. And the only way to get through is where the bison had bulldozed through the cane. It was muddy. It was low country. And there were marauding Indians. There were a lot of things. But anyway, there's a fort now that reenacts 1774. That's located within sight of this gap, along just below the ridge. This is a fantastic reenactment. If you stand in the middle of the fort and there's no airplane going over, you absolutely, if you don't look at your clothes, you cannot tell that you're in the 21st century. You cannot. And anyway, this fort reenacts, as I said, 1774 conditions then. Between 1774 and 1800, they say some 400,000 people walk through this trail, through these canes, the cane bottoms, and through the gap, around almost 500,000 people. This is 1774. Within less than 200 years, the descendants of these people walking and riding horses through Cumberland Gap, their descendants were walking on the moon. In only 196, I subtracted it, it was 196 years. In other words, from 1774, and of course that's not a precise time, that's just the year they chose to reenact in that fort, but that is when this migration was occurring. And we were walking on the moon in 1969, July 20, which if you subtract, it's not even 200 years. Now, if you say that the only way anybody got around for the 10,000 previous years was with animal muscle or human muscle, that's the only thing, way anything was transported, any information was carried. And in less than 200 years, we went from horseback to the moon.
Yeah.
So we are a new kind of people. We have great powers. You know, I go on with these things. this is really unbelievable, but in right around 1800 in England, they began putting steam engines on a platform and tried to move them over. They used wooden rails, and this was all factory work. Mm-hmm. By 1869, on the North American continent, now that's barely 65 years later, they were driving the Golden Spike into the rails that united the east and west coast of the United States and made it possible to go from the east or west coast in a couple of weeks. People don't, I didn't realize these things. I didn't. One of the most shocking things is if you take your steam engine around, you know, starting to have a working steam engine around 1803, 06, thereabout, in England, mm-hmm. by 1944, mm-hmm. which is barely 150 years later, we had jet engines and we had rockets. We had rocket engines. Mm-hmm. We also had actually television, you know.
Right.
And we went from around 1844 was the telegraph. And now that was being done in those days. Telegraphy was done with acid batteries, which had been around for a long time, long time. Mm-hmm. They were very dangerous batteries. They put out a deadly gas. But just around 1844, Samuel F. B. Morse, he invented a code. He made a telegraph. In 1944, which is 100 years later, we were transmitting black and white images wirelessly with the it was television, far vision. Now, this is coming out of nowhere. Then, of course, the internet happened at the end of the last century, and no one really anticipated that. And we're still coping with what it all is. And what it is, I will just tell you, is that we're all in communication, you know, behind the scenes. It's tele-something or other. Telepathy, yeah, mental telepathy. We're all in communication. The more we have in common, more our thoughts are common, the more we're in communication. And the internet is the outside replication, the outside application of that. And I used to tell my kids, because, you know, they like to do this, information message stuff, SMS and all that stuff, mm-hmm. you know, and they had all their iPhones and all that sort of thing. Yeah. And when they got up in the morning, they would start mm-hmm. talking to each other. They were very intensely involved with each other. And I said, you know, what you need to do now is put those things down and see how well you can communicate with each other without them. Just use your phones to confirm. Mm-hmm. The messages you're sending to each other, because they were so involved, you know, they had to know what they were each other. They must know what they're thinking, you know.
Right.
So we do this thing where we externalize our internal capabilities, and that the internet is one of those. I also talk about our powers and abilities. And one of the biggest things I use for that is near-death experiences. Now, when I started writing this, if you went to the internet, of course, I'm not proficient on the internet, but there were only two sites that really discussed near-death experiences. Now there's dozens, and there's books that have come out, and books by medical professionals, of course, which gives everything much more veracity, you know, much more credibility. But anyway, I do an analysis in this book of near-death experience that's not done anywhere. Most near-death experience books talk about the experiences themselves. They become a catalog of what somebody right. saw, you know.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But I start analyzing what the narratives. And it comes out that, for instance, memory is an attribute of the soul. Memory is not in the brain. And, you know, I grew up with several classmates and roommates, actually, in the dormitory who were probing rats' brains, looking for you know, the cells that control this and control that. And everybody wants to find the memory in the brain. But, you know, the near-death person is not, they're disembodied spirits, you know. They're observers. And yet they have eyes to see, ears to hear, and the rational capacity to evaluate what information they're getting.
Right.
You know. And if you take a remote viewer, you know, which is people have, many people have been trained to do remote viewing.
Absolutely.
Well, where, you know, the reviewer is sitting in a room with one of these envelopes in front of them, and yet they're seen. Well, their eyes did not go with them, see?
Right.
So it turns out that our five physical senses are analogies for the senses of the soul. And you know, you hypnotize people and they begin to describe what they see.
Right.
And what people say to them, where they are. Mm-hmm. They are hearing, they have auditory comprehension. And they're able to establish some historical sometimes. But you know, one of the things about what you do is that the soul has experiences there and has memories that the current brain cannot process. Mm-hmm. You know, right. There's no, you guys have people that talk about historical times that are unknown, cultures that are unknown, languages long disappeared. You know, and we think we had it all. We got all the gaps filled. We got all the things filled in.
Right.
Not a bit of it. I love that. See, I just love that stuff.
That's
I really
the mind.
Like it.
So I have a question real quick before we get into something I really want you to share. You talked about Lemuria a little earlier.
Yes.
And that's something that's very intriguing to me. Just very, very briefly, when they were showing you some bits about Lemuria. Can you describe for me very quickly what they were showing?
Well, it was a coastal village, and it looked a lot like something from the Middle East around the time of Christ, if you want, because it was low buildings that were earth tone, earth colors, but it turns out there's a lot of that here in Florida, so it doesn't have to be the Middle East. And actually, there was what was a kind of a street. It wasn't paved because there was no need for pavement because everybody got about, they didn't have to walk if they didn't want to. Mm-hmm. They floated. Everybody was lighter. All the bones were lighter. The whole body was lighter. Mm-hmm. And they had a huge, it looked like a kidney bean is what it looked like. That they used to if they wanted to go a good distance as a group, because they could go they could teleport themselves if they wanted to, which we can do. We just don't think we can, but we can do that.
Exactly.
But anyway, if they wanted to get together as a family, they would get into this. They had entered it from a ladder from below, and they had a garage actually on their house. Where they could put this, and they had an electronic cover over the garage. It was an anti-gravity device. There's some of the ARE people, and there's a fellow, he's an Egyptologist too, and he's spoken at your conference several times, and I tried to write down all the names that I thought would come up. But I've lost his. I've read his books. It's great stuff. But he points out that we have gotten about by anti-gravity devices for hundreds of thousands of years. It's only recently that we have started to use land-based transportation that's hydrocarbon. But anyway, people walked around. And they were actually in robes that were like a togas, Roman togas a lot. They could communicate with or without verbal speech. And this is something I wanted to mention to you. It's kind of amusing. I mentioned this Andrew Wright here, who has two books that I know of, Destiny of the Souls, and I got the other one. Something else, Journey of the Souls.
Mm-hmm.
He describes a new soul who is in a classroom situation, sort of, and he's trying to create matter sitting at this table with some teachers walking around behind them, mm-hmm. and or just whatever they do. Verb is rodé in French. Anyway, they're hanging around behind him. And he asked, he could do soil, but he found that it was hard to keep plant matter together. Well, it turns out I was shown a hall in Lemuria where the youth were being taught in exactly the same setting. And this this practitioner, he's a psychiatrist, he thought this was on another planet.
See? Uh-huh. Okay.
He said, oh, this must have been on another planet. But I was shown the exact same scene long before I read that, that was on this planet. But the life world there was like another planet. But mm-hmm. if you want to know, what did it look like in Lemuria? Well, it looks like Florida. What do you want?
Okay, fantastic. Now, okay. Mm-hmm.
I go on extensively in my second book. I have a big chapter about it. But the Lemurians practice a kind of collective farming, which they did for spiritual education. And as the way they taught their children chemistry and physics and botany and biology, a hands-on type of thing. And they really had, it was sort of like your Roman ranch, your Roman estate, where everybody, except there were no slaves, but everybody contributed and everybody worked. And there were big extended families that all lived together. It was democratic. It was a democratic system, but there were some hierarchies of because of spiritual development. So most of this, the what was settled in Lemuria was on the coasts. But one thing that has to be kept in mind, this is absolutely critical, when you're discussing Lemuria or Atlantis, you have hundreds of thousands of years. So whatever somebody might say about their experience there is just minuscule. You know, yeah. That's mm-hmm. not definitive by in any way. And people forget that. Yeah. You know, it's very easy to forget it. As usual, I'm really running into the time.
Oh, no problem. Well, what I want you to do before we do run out of time is I want you to let people know how they can reach you if they need to. Do you have a Facebook page, website, or email address, anything like that, where people can contact you if they want to?
Yes. Yeah. Well, I have an email that I will allow people to correspond with me. And that's really, I have a Facebook page, which is Lee Sumter, and I have an L.R. Sumter Facebook page, which featured the first version of the book. Mm-hmm. I have not kept those very active.
Okay.
But I do have an email, and it's the P Fort. It's THEPFORT. It's Fort Sumter with a P. Mm-hmm. You know, but I comment nowadays, kids don't have any education, so they don't know what Fort Sumter was or the Civil War. Oops, I'm sorry. Excuse me. Yeah. Well, anyway, that's what it is. It's the P Fort. And it's at hotmail.com.
At hotmail.com, okay.
And so I can take comments from there. However, I will not go into extensive answers. I will give very short answers and you know, tell people, advise people where they can search.
Absolutely. And we want to make an announcement. I mean, the book is available to purchase at ozarkmt.com. And now, and at your bookstores or anything, Amazon.com, of course, and, you know, anywhere you want to, but please get it at OzarkMT.com. But today, I want to let you know, Lee, it just became, I mean, it's been available in ebook form on Amazon, but today,
yes.
We just made it available in EPUB form on Ozark, on the Ozark site.
Oh, really?
So, yes. So if you want to get
great.
It. Yes, so it's in EPUB, which is an ebook format.
Yes.
On the Ozark site, so ozarkmt.com. So
that's great.
That's something we want to announce is we've got that function. We've finally got that part working on our site. So, yes, so that's available. And we want to make sure yours was up for the show tonight. So it is.
Now,
so, yay.
Now, I noticed Shonda she's rubbing her eyes. She's had a long day.
Hey,
Shonda,
been a long day. I went to Rogers this morning for a class, and it's just been nonstop.
Well, Shonda, I should have warned you, and I should warn all the listeners about my voice, because when I would start my classes, my voice would have the most unbelievable effect on students' bladders.
Oh, and they relate.
See, they would, four or five of them instantly would have to go to the bathroom just when I was starting my class, you know. And I always wondered at that, you know, that my voice could have, and I've noticed it has a similar effect on others. So my voice does not always.
Well, we do need to go now. So, yes. Okay, so I want to thank everyone for joining us tonight, and thank you so much, Lee, for being our guest. And thank you, everyone, for joining us. We wish you everybody good night, and until next week, let's all manifest and create a wonderful week, and just good night, everybody.